Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of The World Show, Free Markets, the Langvari Series. This week, we meet an important character on the scene in Washington, D.C. Originally from Chicago, he is someone who has, for instance, done a few things. He changed the quality of life on Capitol Hill, the work, the legislative process. He worked hard to help bring down the ABM Treaty, which in turn helped to bring down the Soviet Union. He inspired Bill Clinton's welfare reform. Who is it? If you're thinking presidents, vice presidents, and speakers, think again. It's Ed Follner, who's the visionary behind the Heritage Foundation. Here he is. Ed Follner, Dr. Follner, it's quite an achievement that you have to your credit. We're going to explore it together. But just to give people just one statistic, years ago you said there weren't 600,000 people in America who knew what a think tank was. Now there may be 600,000 think tanks for all we know. But the Heritage Foundation is the granddaddy of all that. It may not have been the very first, but it's the template that's been imitated by everybody else because of its success and efficiency. How did you do it?
Well, one of the neat things, too, on that particular statistic, Bob, is that we do have 600,000 dues-paying members of the Heritage Foundation, which means they voluntarily every year send us a contribution. No tax money, but voluntary supporters. How do we do it? We did it because we saw a niche. We were, as someone said at the time, we were intellectual entrepreneurs. I know entrepreneurs is a word you love. Mm-hmm. And we take great pride in the fact that we found a market niche in Washington to produce short policy papers where we put all the facts up front. The last two pages, we came to what we thought were very sensible conclusions. And people, as long as they agree on the facts, then let's debate the conclusions, if you will, in the policy arena. And I think that's both an indication we've come a long way away from that, but that's what we should get back to, because if both sides can agree on the facts, then let's let conservatives and liberals in the U.S. context debate it. And that's what Heritage started doing, because the primary product before Heritage for most think tanks was books.
Yeah.
And congressmen, senators, even their key staff aides don't have time to read a whole book on tax reform or health care or the threat in the Middle East or whatever. You've got to boil it down to the basics and get that in front of them and make that be the point where you depart from. These are the basic facts, so let's now debate the issue.
And you introduced the principle of efficiency and you made it central. There's a conversation that's recounted in the research where you're talking to one of your people and you say, okay, you killed a few trees, you gave the librarians some work, you paid a fee to get some stuff done, but what else? Yeah. And you didn't want any of that.
And chances are the study arrived on the congressman or senator's desk 2 days after the vote took place. You know? So why bother? What good is a think tank if it's not relevant to the policy process? That's why when we started 47 years ago, we decided, hey, we have a primary target audience, and that's Capitol Hill, the Congress, House and Senate, and their key staff aides. We're going to locate near them. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be downtown Washington on Embassy Row or midway between the White House and the Capitol. We're going to decide that the Capitol is our target audience. We're going to be as close to the Capitol as we can be.
And you not only introduced efficiency as a central principle to the work, you have a knack for slogans that boil it all down. For instance, the briefcase test.
Yes.
What is that?
Yes. The briefcase test was something we came up with very early, and that is that a congressman or senator going to his or her house or district or house district or state for a weekend, it really matters what's in the briefcase. If we have an 8-page study mm-hmm. on a pending issue that might be up a week or 2 weeks later or might be before the committee 2 weeks later, it's very likely that'll get in. If we've got a 400-page book, he's not going to take that back and forth in his mm-hmm. briefcase. So that was the basic idea of a briefcase test. And again, today these things sound very simple, but I'll tell you, half a century ago, they were brand new.
And is there a special pleasure when you convince somebody on the quote-unquote other side? For instance, the Clinton welfare reform is widely credited to you and the work that the foundation did. Is that more fun than convincing quote-unquote Ronald Reagan?
I don't know if it's more fun, but I guess we we take greater satisfaction from conversions. But I remind my colleagues, too, that we're not a religion. We're not basically in the conversion business. If you take a target audience like the Congress, my old law is you divide it into three big parts, the saints, the sinners, and in between the savables.
That's pretty religious.
Well, I guess the saints you want to reinforce, the savables you want to bring to your side, and the sinners, maybe once in a while you'll get the convert, but that's not where you focus.
Let them burn.
Well, I wouldn't be quite that candid, but yes.
And do you resent it, though, when people pigeonhole you? This I notice also in the research at some point you say, we're not Republicans, we're conservatives.
That's right.
But that's a hard message to bring across if the Republicans adopt a lot of your ideas, Democrats don't. Democrats attack you by name. You end up being pushed into that political partisan arena. How do you fight that?
You fight it intensely and constantly. We, in days gone by, arguing in favor of airline deregulation. We found ourselves on the side of Ted Kennedy, opposed to conservative Republicans who kind of liked the status quo. They were comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes there are strange political outcomes when you stick with a certain set of principles. One of our mottos also is our role is to run the flag up the flagpole and see who salutes. And it just so happens mm-hmm. most of the time those conservatives happen to have R's after their name instead of D's after their name.
And you grew, this is an entrepreneurial angle, you grew from 9 employees to 250, and you pointed out the revenues grew, and the revenues are free and clear, they're given by people voluntarily. I'm interested in that. When you started, it could have fit in this room, right?
Right.
And now it would take a building. But how did you do it?
We had a fundamental belief that if you read the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, if you read Forbes magazine or Business Week, that there was a broad base of people out there who these publications must be appealing to. How do we reach them directly in terms of what's going on Capitol Hill? Very early on, I learned a lesson. I had a debate with Ralph Nader. And he accused us of being the stooges of big business. And I accused him of being a stooge of government because all of his funding for his campus activities came out of state funds from PIRGs, as they were called, the public interest groups on campuses. But I went back to the office and said to our guys and gals that we had to take a new look in terms of what our base of support should be. How do we reach those people who fundamentally agree with us but who don't really have access mm-hmm. immediately to power? So we started with an old conservative outreach device called direct mail. We started doing that. That built up our base. At various times, we did radio advertising to reach out beyond that, even occasional television ads. And that's how we gradually built up so that before Reagan was elected, we had more than 100,000. Supporters.
Wow.
By the time he left, we were over 200,000. And now, as I say, we're between 500 and 600,000 supporters every year.
And it's interesting that you were very clear about, well, here you're talking about the population. And within that, the congressional population was your priority.
Right.
I'm told your office even has a view onto the Capitol, just to remind everybody what it's about. Therefore, you ignored kind of the media. A lot of think tanks will report proudly how many times they're mentioned in the media, and that's their claim to fame.
Yeah.
That's not your priority.
That's not our priority, but at the same time, one of the other things we did decide early on, I'm glad you brought this up, Bob, because local media oftentimes will have more of an impact on a member of the House or a member of the Senate. She will more often read the Ardmore, Oklahoma Daily Ardmoreite than read the New York Times or the Washington Post. So if we can get a piece placed in the Daily Ardmoreite, that really matters. And that's something that we focused on early and intensely, and it's very important still to this day.
And obviously you've been imitated. This is such a winning formula, and imitated, I suppose, in the same camp and in the adversary camp. How has that unfolded?
Ah, yeah, Yeah.
Have they cannibalized your people?
They have. We have just recently I received another email that was fairly sensible from a former colleague who's now over at the liberal left Brookings Institution. We have some of our alums who are over at the Libertarian Cato Institute or at the American Enterprise Institute. And I view us all as being competitors in the realm of ideas. And I love the idea of competition of ideas. That's what we should be thriving on in the think tank business. Another Heritage alum is the head of the Hoover Institution's Washington office. So we have alumni all over, and we don't resent that. We kind of view it as, hey, we made a good decision early on that this person had real merit and somebody else thinks so too. So it's a multiplication kind of case.
And do you guys all go to the same restaurants and, you know, work the tables and eavesdrop on each other? I mean, you are a population. You're a subset.
We are, really. And it was very interesting. We were at a book release of a recent volume on ranking think tanks around the world. And I was there with Strobe Talbot, who recently resigned as president of the Brookings Institution. And he said publicly from the podium that one of the first calls he got when he went to Brookings was from Ed Fulner inviting him to have lunch so that Ed Fulner could talk to him about think tanks as an industry and what we could learn from each other. And boy, we learn a lot from Brookings, and I think they learn some things from us. And that's good, because again, if it sharpens the debate of ideas, if it makes people better educated across the political spectrum, that's all to the good.
And turning now to the political realm, a lot of people are distressed, as you know, and maybe it's a cliche or maybe it's true, about the intense partisanship that doesn't seem to have been there in the old days, the old days being a few years ago.
Yeah.
And gerrymandering has played a role, since each state can play with federal districts, and they do. Are you distressed by that, or do you think it's part of democracy?
It's just the way the system is evolving. It's something that I guess everyone left and right has to come to grips with. What's just as distressing to me, I think, is what's happening in those political definitions is the fact that so many people end up just listening to or reading the people with whom they agree. And, you know, that kind of divides people into different camps. Jeepers, you know, I don't read just one newspaper a day. I read as many as I can and with different opinions, and try to read columnists and editorials with which I know I'm going to disagree, just to make sure that my arguments are sharp and to say, hey, wait a minute, there's something I never thought of before. How does that fit in? And that concerns me about the future of democracy. And particularly, I remember one time being on a shuttle from Washington to New York. I ended up accidentally sitting next to the liberal Republican, the late Senator Jacob Javits.
Yeah.
And I asked him how he had been successful as a Republican being elected and reelected so many times in New York. And he said, well, one of the things you have to learn is how you can condense your message into a minute and a half soundbite. Well, a minute and a half today seems like an eternity.
It would be a feature film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's 250 characters that you have to condense your message into. And trying to do that and still maintain a commitment to the nuances in these arguments, that's a challenge.
And people are nostalgic. They say it wistfully. They talk about that legendary beer that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan would have at the end of the day. And people really desire that. But how will we ever find our way back? Anytime, not bipartisan, but less partisan politicians come forward, sometimes as twins, and say we've got this initiative or that, the very radical elements in each party shoot them down.
Yeah,
so there seems
to
be no way out of that.
It's a big challenge. I have a different recollection of Tip O'Neill. One time he came over, I've forgotten exactly what the issue or the occasion was, but he came. Of course, I knew he was coming. He was the incumbent Speaker of the House. I met him at the front door, and he took a step in after we shook hands, and he greeted me. And I said, well, we're going to the elevator, Mr. Speaker. He said, no, I want to stand here for a meeting for a minute to make sure the walls don't fall down on me. Because it was obviously his first time there.
Yeah.
But beyond that, and I do recall a time, a dozen years ago, I was appearing, testifying before a House committee, and Bernie Sanders was the senior Democrat on the House side at that time. And he said, that's a very interesting argument you brought up. I'll have to think about that. And I thought to myself, boy, you know, that's an achievement to just have somebody with whom I know I could, in fact, have an intelligent conversation, but with whom I disagree.
And do you get, I assume you draw pride out of, there are some things that you've achieved or have been instrumental in achieving that have really changed the world. Missile defense. You worked hard to make sure that that was on the agenda. A lot of people were working hard against that. We know now from historians that Gorbachev and the Russians were terrified of that whole thing. Whether it was perfected or not didn't matter. It brought them into line and it contributed to their fall. That's earth-shaking, literally. No pun intended. How do you feel about that?
Yes. It was, in fact, one of the major achievements of our whole time, really, at Heritage, in terms of changing the whole framework of the debate. And it was, you know, we're the ones who popularized the notion, who pulled together the scientists and the policy experts to say, yes, it is conceivable, it can be done, and here are the people in the U.S. Air Force who could have the vision to make it happen, and the right general to head up the program and all the rest. And we went to President Reagan with it. He liked the idea because he had always maintained that MAD, mutually assured destruction, that if they bomb us, we'll bomb the hell out of them, and then they'll bomb us again, and, you know, everything's gone, that there had to be a better way. And when we came up with the more practical implementation of how it could happen, now it still isn't perfect, it still isn't there 30-some years later, but it did, in fact, make Gorbachev really pull back in terms of the Soviet Union, and we believe it fundamentally changed the whole correlation of forces, if you will, and led to the downfall of the whole Soviet Empire. And here we are more than 100 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, and it's over.
Yeah, it is incredible and successful. Now, in areas where we were talking about partisanship, there are other areas where progress is not so obvious. Probably if we polled Americans on that, the wish list, what would you really like to solve once and for all, race would come up as one of the two or three intractable problems. It just never gets... never harmonious through each presidency, through each decade. Is there a way out?
I guess I have a harder time than some people in terms of relating to that as a conflict, because I've had so many individual friends over the years, whether it was Indians when I was at the London School of Economics who were fellow conservatives, whether it was African Americans when I was a college undergraduate or now on my board at the Heritage Foundation with whom I work every day, that I have a hard time relating to the intransigence that some whites have to relating to what's happening now in the real world. I'm a native of Chicago. Right now in Chicago, the population of Chicago, yes, there are a large number of African Americans, but it's also 30% Hispanic. I mean, this is very different from when I grew up in Chicago 60 years ago. And, you know, the world is changing. We as conservatives have to come to grips with that. And I guess we have to get rid of stereotypes. That's what bothers me most. And here, you mentioned earlier the whole issue of welfare reform in 1996. Yeah. And I look back on that and I think, boy, there we were. We had a 5-year experiment. All the numbers were right. The number of illegitimate children was down. The number of working people who had formerly been on welfare was up. And on and on. All the numbers were working right, but it wasn't renewed because the intransigence of some people on the Hill who just wanted the status quo. Then I talk to the policy people and they say, remember, Dr. Fulmer, that was one of 81 means-tested welfare programs. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of work that still has to be done by the think tank community in terms of how you rationalize. And nobody in their right mind can say that you need 82 different programs, 81 and the one that we tried to amend. You know, there have to be overlaps, and all that means is that the entrenched establishment bureaucracy loves the way it is because there's more jobs for them. And that's why, well, at this stage of the game in a Trump administration, there's a lot of construction going on in Washington. But boy, during the Obama administration, there was a lot of construction in Washington, too. You know, Washington flourishes no matter who's in charge.
And in speaking of intractable situations and more abroad than here, the great enemy of freedom is totalitarianism. It's the antonym, the perfect opposite. Yeah. And it doesn't go away either. It changes names, communism, Chavism, you name it. Yeah. And sometimes they masquerade a little bit and say that they are actually a free economy, so it doesn't matter that they control their people. Will we see the end of totalitarianism?
Human beings are not perfectible. There will never be a utopia in this world, I don't believe, which means that, no, it's going to be an eternal struggle, I think, almost like the struggle between good and evil. Mm-hmm. It's a struggle between whether man aspires to something higher or whether there is a person or a group that can somehow control people and determine for them what is the best way forward for them. I don't think there should be. I think that we ought to encourage more people to be able to live up to their full potential. Equality of opportunity is what we're all about at Heritage and as conservatives in the United States. And boy, I want that for everybody, no matter the color of their skin or their political beliefs. And how do we expand that? That's what I would like to see. And that way, you'll at least be, well, basically maintaining the status quo, but hopefully expanding opportunity, expanding freedom, and kind of rolling back totalitarianism at the margin.
And what's particularly scary is when it seems to work. I mean, when it's Chavez or Cuba, the economy falls apart, and it's sort of the proof is in the pudding that it's a worthless system. But when the Chinese keep the lid on, and at a cost of incredible suffering in their population, it seems to work. And a lot of pro-socialists and so on rejoice at that. That is scary.
It is. And there I go back to a fundamental view that Margaret Thatcher expressed a number of times, both when she was visiting China and later in her visits to the United States, reflecting on her visits around the world. She said, you look at China, and yes, there is motion toward economic freedom for the individual. And the more economic freedom there is, the other side of that coin is going to be political freedom. So how do you make sure then that, well, maybe it'll be local elections in the provincial level or at the city level, then how does that expand? And chances are it doesn't expand by power vested in a single person or a single small group, but rather through what we in the United States call the federal system, where you have different laboratories for democracy, really, to try different things.
And one thing I discovered in the research that I didn't know, you've been admirably constant. Yeah, at some point, I'm reading a text where you're giving your beliefs, and I say, oh, yes, that's his beliefs. But then there's a line in there that says, since I'm of draftable age, so then I realize you wrote this in college.
Yeah.
So you were already thinking like this way back.
Way back, yeah. I had a particular history professor as an undergraduate. I studied with the Jesuits at Regis University in Denver. And this layman put me on to a European thinker, Erich von Kuhnelt-Leddihn, long since passed. From that, I started reading Russell Kirk. National Review was already out for a few years, so I was so excited to start reading National Review. And that kind of hooked me on the whole conservative philosophy that here was something that I really could agree with. I mentioned entrepreneur earlier, and gosh, I can't remember when I started being an entrepreneur. You know, in high school, before I got my first real job, my father said, okay, here's this piece. And we had an acre-sized lot in suburban Chicago. He said, I'll give you this corner. You can grow anything you want there. I'll give you $10 for seeds. But if you sell anything, you got to pay me back the 10 bucks. So, man, I tried to figure out what to buy.
He was your banker.
I bought some tomato plants, but I also planted peppers and radishes and carrots. And I go around the neighborhood, and boy, I paid off that 10 bucks, and I made a few dollars that summer. And, you know, I was a very early entrepreneur. Then I tried strawberries, but strawberries took too long. You know,
yeah,
they were a couple
it
seasons.
It rains too much. Yes. So, Dr. Fulner, now you're planting ideas, and they're certainly growing. So long life to you and to Heritage.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Bob.
Ed Fulner of the Heritage Foundation was our guest this week on Free Markets, the Langvari series of the World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.